Now, I have needs to hear about movies. You know, I talk about the theater here all the time because I'm a big Broadway person. I'm a big Broadway lover and also a theater critic for 2 decades now, and I co-publish Performing Arts Insider magazine. But it doesn't mean I don't love film. In fact, that was my first love before theater, seeing foreign movies on Channel 13 by Ingmar Bergman and Kurosawa and Zhang Renoir, and when Cinema 13 would show those
okay,
things,
show
and
off.
Silent film. No, I want to show up. This is, I loved it. I was immersed in that before I went to college, and pointed me in the direction of taking film and television in college.
What was the last movie you saw?
Recently?
Yeah.
I showed it at the local library, Quantum of Solace, the most recent James Bond film. Quite disappointing. Not my kind of movie anyway. Not that I'm being snobbish about it. A good James Bond film is a good movie, but this one was kind of the cutting was so operatic and ridiculous. No, I don't think there was a shot in that movie that lasted more than 2.5 seconds. Anywho, why ask about the movies that I'm seeing when we can ask James Selvidge, who has seen more than 30,000 films in his lifetime.
30,000?
He's shown a few thousand,
too. How many hours is that?
Well, let's ask him ourselves. James Selvidge, are you there with us?
Right. How are you, Dave?
How are you, James? Thanks so much for calling and taking the time on this Sunday evening.
Glad to.
Is 30,000 a correct number for how many movies you've watched over the years?
And counting.
And counting.
And you figure the average movie is about 2 hours long?
Well, for the first half of my life, in Seattle, there were theaters that showed 3 films for 35 cents. So I spent many days seeing 6 to 8 movies a day.
Wow.
And that adds up.
But those were like monogram. I'll bet most of the movies then were about 55 to 65 minutes also, no?
Well, more like 80.
Really? Even about, okay. Because I remember my dad used to tell stories of, people's parents and grandparents used to tell the stories of going to the movies on Saturday morning at 11 and not coming out until 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and they just see movie after movie after movie and shorts and documentaries and mini-features and all that kind of thing. But you ran a movie theater, didn't you?
I had a circuit of theaters, yes.
In Seattle?
Seattle, Portland,
Other
cities.
What made you get into that field?
Well, basically, by the time I got out from the Korean War, I'd seen close to 8,000 movies. But then college and during Korea, I saw a lot of foreign films.
And foreign films?
Yeah, and most of them...
Foreign, not foreign.
...seemed to me to be far superior.
Uh-huh.
This was a time when Hollywood was Rock Hudson, Doris Day, cookie cutter, you know, popcorn entertainment. And
mm-hmm.
Foreign films made you think, made you, you know, talk about it. That was the origins of the round the water cooler dialogues movies.
Uh-huh.
And so I was sure that Seattle was big enough to support a theater on foreign films only. And I was naive in my thinking at the time, but I leased a theater and made some connections in New York and opened up. Now,
mm-hmm.
if you'll let me real quick, there's
sure.
two backstories, two things that I didn't know. First, that Seattle, from World War II until 1970, was the XXX porno production capital of the United States.
And I knew we'd get to porno eventually.
Thank goodness,
and
yeah.
Because an indiscreet employee got busted and wound up in prison in 1954,
yeah.
They originated the Seattle Board of Theater Supervisors. And actually what their job was to view every porno film, codify it, stamp it as not obscene, and for 20 years... In Seattle and the cities around the country that they serviced, there was never a bust because the prosecuting attorney would say, "What do you want from me?" You know, the censor board says it's not obscene.
Hmm.
But I didn't know this at the time, and all I knew was that Hollywood had declared, based based on the first rash of great films like Bicycle Thief, that they would not import a foreign film, they wouldn't distribute a foreign film, and they wouldn't allow their theaters to show a foreign film. And
well, it was also the McCarthy era, yeah.
The rationale they claimed to the media was that the public wouldn't pay to see a film in a foreign language where you had to read subtitles. But the second film that I played was Proud and the Beautiful, and there was a scene where in Mexico a couple is traveling and the husband gets sick and they send him to the hospital, and the wife goes into a cantina motel and gets a room.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scene where she takes off her stockings, and the theater board says, that's got to go, you can't show that. And my attorney explained to them that we couldn't cut any film because it would violate the copyright, and all we could do is make it adults only. And
did that solve the problem? In other words, as long as you don't let... This is before, obviously, the rating system. So if you just said, hey, we're not going to let anybody under 17 in, the ratings board was okay.
No, well, unfortunately, that wasn't the case. 3 days later, I had a notice to appear before the Seattle City Council on a show cause hearing why my license shouldn't be revoked. And this happened at least once a month.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Second thing I found out was that the real reason Hollywood had said no was because of Joe McCarthy, the John Birch Society, something called the House Un-American Activities Committee, and the blacklist. I actually, in the period I was in the business, got to know some of those where somebody pointed a finger at him and said he's a sympathizer, and he was blacklisted from the industry for most of the rest of his life.
Who was that?
Well, it was a long list, but one that became a Bridgemont patron was Jules Dassin, who had been a top screenwriter and director in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s.
Did he do Top Copy?
He did Never on Sunday, Top Copy, He Who Must Die. He did some great films in Europe, but he had to work there totally.
Oh, because he was blacklisted.
He was never allowed to come back here.
But what did the McCarthy people and the John Birch people have against films from... was Franks seen as
common?
Well,
they had a common mantra. All foreign films are part of the communist conspiracy. So if you were showing a foreign film, you were a communist. I have in my scrapbook a newspaper with a 5-column picture on the front page of the front of my theater with people lined up to see the show, and the caption refers to it as a communist cell where admission is whispering to the cashier, ACLU.
Really?
That's God's truth.
What newspaper was this?
This was the Yakima Republic.
The Yakima Republic. Well, there you go. It was the New York Post of its day.
The publisher was actually the president of the John Birch Society.
Whoa.
Well, he's out of business now.
So
yeah, mainly because of my attorney.
All right.
Let me ask you, speaking of attorneys and stuff like that, James Selvidge, how did Brigitte Bardot almost get you into jail?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got 2.5 generations now that may not know who she is, but back in the mid-50s, at that time, fairly prominent French director married her and starred her in And God Created Woman. It was a huge success abroad, and it was sold in the United States to National Theaters, which was the circuit for Fox. Mm-hmm. And to United Drive-Ins, which was the largest drive-in circuit in the world. And boom, the censors said, you can't show this, it's condemned.
Too sexy for them, huh?
Yeah. So these the foreign films in those days were handled by very small distributing companies that literally worked out of a briefcase in a maybe 300 square foot office.
Mm-hmm.
And it was handled by a fellow named Peter Horner, who ran Kingsley International. He called me up and told me what was happening and if I could help him. So I said, well, if you can find me a French language print with subtitles and let me design my own ad campaign, I'll play it. And I did. It was a huge success. And
so
actually, as a byproduct, this is a quick anecdote.
Wait, so you actually presented God and God Created Women?
Yeah, and
that's what got you in trouble?
Yeah, this movie, I'll politely call it coincidence, but most censor boards in those days were majority Catholic, and they had what's called the Legion of Decency, and anything that they cited as C for condemned, which was a mortal sin, was poison at the box office.
Right.
And Hollywood wouldn't touch it. Well, they were so upset that they not only made the movie a C picture condemned, but they made her condemned. So in 1962, 4 years later,
mm-hmm.
I played The Truth, which starred her in a film by Henri-Georges Clouzot, who was one of the top directors in France.
He's the fellow who did Diabolique. And
yeah, he made Diabolique and Wages of Fear.
Right.
And I screened the movie for the critics on Monday. Again, this was a film that was to be a general release but was condemned. I showed it to the critics on Monday, and Tuesday morning's paper, well, both papers had banner headlines, Selvidge to be arrested. So when the film opened, the censor board is required by law to watch the first showing with the public so that they can testify in court that that's the film that they condemn.
Uh-huh.
So when intermission came around, I was standing out on the sidewalk, and it was like daylight because all three networks were there with their trucks and across the top of each Kleeglied. And the regular patrons came out first, and then I saw through the door the censor board kind of circle like a football huddle in the lobby. And the chairman of the board came out while the others kind of scurried like cockroaches down the sidewalk. He put his hand to my ear and leaned over and whispered, with subtitles, it's more artistic. That kept me out of jail.
It's amazing the little things, those little bitty coincidences and the little quirks of people can make the difference in that case, rather than just something as simple as logic. Let me ask you, we're talking with James Selvidge, who is, by the way, the author of a book. You've written about your experiences running these theaters and also dealing with people like the lovely John Birch Society and these idiot, well, maybe not so idiotic censors, maybe people doing their jobs and also trying to wink, wink and tell you that they're really shouldn't be doing the jobs that they're doing. But tell us just a little bit about your book.
Well, basically, the book is two books in one.
Mm-hmm.
The first third is intended, and I think meets the bill, a history of those two decades. By nature of the politics of the time, almost all of the so-called art theaters, as the media named them, ran adults only. And this was in part to avoid vandalism as much as it was the content of the film. Anyway, the
Yeah.
Excuse me, it's a quick senior moment.
Sure.
The pressure that came from both sides of the coin, the political, meaning McCarthy and Birch, and the censor boards on the other side, was a real inhibitor of our building an audience. But
well, didn't you? I read somewhere that your theater was at one point sort of attacked, and your car was. What happened? Your car was smashed.
Well, the John Birch Society was, believe it or not, much more vicious than Joe McCarthy. I was driving down I-5 to a legislative hearing when the windshield of my car was blown out by a shotgun.
Wow.
And fortunately, it came in from an angle, and I wound up with white hair and ear, nose, and mouth filled with powdered glass, but I didn't get hurt.
No shots, huh?
But I was a victim of two assaults that put me in the hospital, three attempts to burn the theater down, and then the theater board had a cute little trick. The censor board, when they were frustrated regularly by the brilliance of my attorney...
What's his name, your attorney?
William Dwyer.
We have to give him his...
Yeah, give him some props. Yeah.
He wound up as the only Democrat appointed to the federal bench by Ronald Reagan in his 8 years of office.
Good for him.
Cool.
Probably the only...
The book is dedicated to him. And anyway, the greatest assault was on a picture called Point of Order, which was a documentary made out of kinescopes of the McCarthy Army hearings when McCarthy was claiming that half the Pentagon were communists.
I've seen that film. It's Emil D'Antonio was the director, and it's pretty good. But that was already made after McCarthy had his what's the opposite of comeuppance? Well, it was his comeuppance, or
his
was that
downs.
Before?
The
come down.
Yeah, that was it, that
Joseph
film
Welch
really too. Was ended on a note where everybody had walked out on him, and he was pounding on the desk with the gavel, point of order, point of order.
So he had already been discredited, and yet you're showing this documentary of his discrediting.
His discreditation.
Nearly caused more trouble?
A decade later,
and that's still...
On opening night, they pelted the theater with rotten eggs. Next night, light bulbs. Oof. The third night, I showed up, and the whole front of the theater was smeared with excrement. And the fourth night, they slashed the tires on all my car. They were responsible also for the three arson attempts.
Did you sue them?
My attorney did, actually, but in another case, they alleged that a fellow named John Goldmark, who I knew he and his wife quite well, he was a senator from Eastern Washington and running for re-election, and they called him a communist, and it cost him the election. And my attorney sued for libel, and I think there were 20 that got multimillion-dollar...
No, but did you ever get anything back from them after all the crap they gave you?
No.
Literally.
The only thing that brought relief was that the same year that this happened, Swedish director Ingmar Bergman released his film The Silence, and again the censor board condemned it, said it can't play. And the chairman of the board went on TV and described at length a scene that is not in the movie.
There is a scene in the film where a woman masturbates, but you don't actually see anything. Unfortunately.
No.
It'd be a better film if you did.
In fact, I'll argue with you that she was masturbating. All you see is the close, tight shot of her head, and a woman that seems to be in agony. So
yeah,
because,
right,
she came off the train in agony, and something was radically wrong, and her sister puts her in the hotel and heads to try to find a doctor. You don't know whether she's having a heart attack or a stroke or...
Or just plain stroking, yeah.
Yeah.
But we kind of have to wrap this up, but please, please, how can people get... First of all, what is the name of your book, and how can people get it?
Well, the book is Bergman, Fellini, Kurosawa, The Foreign Film in America.
Oh.
But if they will Google www.foreignfilminamerica.com, they'll not only get our website, but a lot of other listings by critics and people that have read it so far. And,
so it's www.foreignfilminamerica.com?
Yeah.
Foreign film or and films?
On our website, there's an order form that if they want, they can order it direct.
Well, cool. It's all an appreciation of the films and also your story, correct?
Well, where I broke off with the senior moment, the third of the book, as I said, is history. The other two thirds is coverage of the 330 greatest films from that two decades.
Oh, all right. What's the top film? What's the number one film for you?
The Seventh Seal is a drama.
Yes.
And the Mr. Hulot trilogy by Jacques Tati is comedy.
Huh. I never got into the Tati films. They didn't make me laugh enough. But Seventh Seal,
really?
I'm so with you.
I've seen Mr. Hulot's Holiday 39 times, and it still breaks me up.
It is an acquired taste. I really wanted to acquire it, but every time I see a Tati film, even Playtime, which is the one I kind of like the best, I want to like it more than I actually do. Oh, well. That's what makes horse racing, since that's kind of your sideline as well.
As a parting shot,
yeah.
If you don't mind, this I didn't know until after the book was published and we started our marketing, which was just a couple months ago. Out of those 330 films, 200 are now available on DVD through Netflix. Now, I have nothing
only
to do with them. I'm not...
Yeah.
I'm
surprised that it isn't a higher number at this stage, since everything gets saved and released on... I'm surprised it isn't closer to 300, let alone 2.
Well, no. It's because it's not that easy to get the rights. And some of these films... Even in the theatrical period, for instance, the Polish film Saragossa Manuscript, which is right up there with Bergman, it took me almost 2 years to find who had the authority to sell the U.S. rights, which I got, and I was a distributor for 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And then it disappeared off the face of the earth until now it's available on Netflix.
Okay.
Criterion Films, which is restoring so many films, and where most are available for purchase, they have a major crew, including partnership with Janus Films, which handled all of Bergman's and who I distributed for in the West.
Because you were talking about purchasing films. Do you have an extensive film library of your own at home?
Well, I have on DVD, particularly Bergman and Tati.
But, I mean, you don't have, like, just 20 DVDs. Do you have, like...
Pardon?
Thousands of DVDs? Or?
Oh, no, not thousands. No, okay.
So you know, I actually did the math on your... what was it? 30,000 films?
That's roughly 500 a week.
Well,
I mean a year.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not only that. It's actually 2,500 days in the theater, which is about 6.5 years of your life you have spent in a movie theater.
Well, I'm surprised it's not more than that.
Yeah, I mean, more.
Well, then maybe you're you're vastly underestimating the number of films you've seen.
The I'm up for Guinness Book of Records in 2010. I think I'm going to get it. But I'm. They use the term film buff a lot.
Yeah.
I'm also a film nut. Because of my father, as a matter of coincidence,
mm-hmm.
I was seeing 10 or 12 films a year starting at age 8.
Wow.
1936.
That's a lot back then.
Then once I got into the industry, I was living in.
Well, yeah, if you were showing movies, you'd see the same film 5 times a week, you know, or. Aside from the fact that you saw Mr. Ulo's Holiday 39 times, so that doesn't count in the 30,000 films he's seen.
He's seen
39.
Well, you know,
more.
I bet you he spent more of his life in the dark than in the sunlight.
Don't we all? I don't even know. Anyway,
In Seattle we had 8 theaters that ran 24 hours a day.
Wow!
So it was very common for me to go in at 10 at night and come out at noon. And my introduction to foreign films was I did teach a year in Bakersfield, and weekends I went to L.A. on what I called movie marathons. And I literally, you know, lived in the theaters that were owned by Mayfair Pictures at the time.
So you didn't have to have a hotel room.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, James Selvidge, we've really got to move on, but I want to thank you so much. Everybody, go get James Selvidge's book. It is S-E-L-V-I-D-G, James Selvidge.
You are a fascinating man.
Foreign Films in America. I hope you live long enough to see 30,000 more foreign films and report back to us on them.
I'm an ancient 80 now, so that's not likely, but I might make it another 5.
Another 5,000 will work.
Call us another 5,000.
You got it. Thank you so much for calling in, and really, really, best of luck with the book, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good one.
Bye.